Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is social PR and crowdfunding expert Ariel Hyatt. But first of all, are the streaming wars over? Well, some people think they are. The reason why is between Spotify and Apple Music, they basically have two-thirds of all the paying customers. And right now, that means somewhere a little less than 60 million. The big problem here is that all of the other services are actually losing a little bit. And here we have Apple Music and we have Spotify that are going up. Now, the problem that the Deezers of the world and the Tidals of the world have is they just don't have deep enough pockets to be able to compete with the Spotifys and the Apple Musics. The only companies that can possibly compete in the future are going to be Amazon and Google, and mostly because music isn't their primary way of making money. And that's the same thing with Apple Music. That's the one thing that Spotify has going against it, the fact that if they don't make money from music, they're out of business. And when it comes to Apple and Google and Amazon, if they don't make any money from music, it's not a big deal. So that's why in the future, I think you're going to see that there's maybe going to be three major streaming networks. And at least for right now, Spotify and Apple Music are two of those. And we'll see what happens with Google and Amazon. Amazon might surprise you in the future because, in fact, they're really going to roll out a nice service. So look for that in the future. There'll probably be one non-interactive service that will be left as well. Most likely that will be Pandora, but it could be iHeartRadio as well. Now, what we're talking about is Europe and the United States, because when it comes to the East, Tencent out of China basically has that all wrapped up. And of course, in Japan, they're really not into streaming music. They're still buying physical product. So that's a ways away before streaming music actually catches on there. So it's a little different in the East than it is from the West. But I think you're going to see fewer and fewer streaming music choices as the years go on. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. You can also check out my music industry and music production blogs. Just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, and you can also read excerpts from my books. Now, when it comes to music production, is software cheating? There are some brand new plugins that just came out that may or may not revolutionize mixing. One is iZotope's Neutron that they just showed a few weeks ago at the AES show, which is kind of revolutionary in that it looks at your mix, it looks at a particular track, and it figures out what the EQ ought to be, and then it will look at your mix and will look at other tracks and figure out what is masking what frequencies and figure out what those are as well. So that's pretty revolutionary. There's also another company, a smaller company called Soundways, that has a couple of interesting plugins as well. One is called Reveal that lets you kind of zoom in the mix in a way that you couldn't before. And another is Low Leveler that looks at what your low level frequency response is and kind of figures that out for you. And then, of course, we have Audified Mix Checker, which allows you to check your mix as if it's in different environments. So you can check it as if you're in your car. You can check it as if you're listening on a boombox. It simulates all those environments and all those different playback devices. So for some people, especially some of the more classic engineers, they think this is cheating. And in fact, what ends up happening is it's making people mix differently because now, especially with Neutron, you have something that's figuring out the EQ for you. With Low Leveler, it's also figuring out your low end, which is a calling card for many mixers. And as a result, I think you're going to find that many engineers who've come up through the ranks and have a lot of experience might look at this and say, I don't know, this is kind of cheating. Because now you should be able to come up with some good mixes without having to actually go through some of the experience. I actually think that that's wrong. It just goes to prove if you rely too much on plugins, if you rely too much about mixing with your eyes rather than your ears, you're going to run into trouble. And all of these plugins are just starting points. And once you realize that they're starting points, and in fact, they can and should be tweaked by the engineer, then I think we're going to come to a better place. But right now, they look like fix-alls. They look like something that, in fact, is going to kind of make a mixer obsolete, but I think we're far from that. My guest today is Ariel Hyatt, who is one of the first PR people to realize the benefits of social media. Her cyber PR agency has worked with thousands of clients, including many, many artists and bands, to help increase their online presence ever since she decided to specialize in this area. Ariel's new book is called CrowdStart, and it focuses on everything you wanted to know about crowdfunding, and it's a book that I highly recommend. I spoke with Ariel via Skype from her office in Brooklyn. So welcome back, Ariel. You were on episode 55 in April of last year, so it's been about a year and a half. And I rarely have guests back, but you're the one I'd always love to talk to anytime. And you have something really great to talk about anyway, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm smiling from ear to ear because it's, I think we definitely talked about this a year and a half ago. This has been a long time coming project. So I'm happy I finally am not the girl who cried wolf.
Well, I read the book over the last few days, and I have to say, it's your best work. It's fabulous. And just to show you how much I think of it, I wish I would have wrote it.
Oh,
I look at it and
you.
I think this is so brilliant. It's very easy to read. The concepts are all there. Very easy to grab the concept of many things because you're talking about social media as well as crowdfunding. So I guess my first question is, why did you write a book on crowdfunding? Where did that come from?
I think I'm the opposite of that saying, those that can't do, teach. You know, I like to do and teach because I think it's sort of my give back to the community. But where this came from, it came from two places. Place number one is working with musicians my whole adult life and watching this glorious fall of Rome. Since we started, you know, I started in the business in 1994. This was when it was normal for independent musicians to make $1 million a year in album sales and on the road. And there was a formula back then. And obviously, all that has so radically changed that as I went through iteration and iteration with my business and watching artists being forced to go through that, I realized crowdfunding and raising money is a critical component to what you need to do in your career to succeed. So that was the first, that was sparked my interest in it. And watching artists that I knew who were doing it, and they would often ask us, because we run a PR firm here, you know, can you help us publicize this? Or what can we do to make our campaign stronger? So I started helping artists, giving them feedback. So I was privy to what campaigns were looking like and feeling like and how much money you could actually raise. And then I decided to do it myself because I really had a deep desire to rebrand and write a book and actually hire a real editor and a real graphic designer instead of sort of doing it all myself with the extra shekels I had left over in my bank account. So I decided to go for it myself. And when I realized just how brutally hard it is to do a crowdfunding campaign, I decided it was my duty to write it down and explain it to everyone else. And I did promise that in my campaign video. I said, whatever happens here, I'm going to teach you whatever it is I learned. And boy, did I learn through that process.
What was your big takeaway from that? Was there one?
Yeah, there were two. I mean, the first one is there's a lot of people out there who love and support you, and you might not even know they're there until you do something like this. That was a giant one. And the second one, and I talk about this pretty extensively in the book, is it's really about the journey and not the destination. As much as you do a crowdfunding campaign because you want your money and you have a reason for it and that's the goal, there is another incredible thing that happens when you do it, which is you see your super fans and you see people in your community that might not have occurred to you before. And you see generosity from strangers and from people that were never actually given an opportunity in the first place to give you more than, you know, whatever you're charging for your CD or your download or your t-shirt or your, you know, your show.
I was really struck by the first chapter, I guess, or it might be the prelude to the book, where you're talking about the two big events in your life that led to this, and the one being the fire in your apartment, and then how all the people that you didn't expect came to help. First of all, yeah. I didn't know you had a fire. When was this?
Oh, this was in 2008.
Oh, okay.
Or 2007, somewhere around there.
But it was interesting that a lot of people came out of the woodwork that you didn't expect that turned out to be very helpful to you, and then the people that you expected to be helpful were not.
Yeah, I think that anyone that's gone through anything heavy, like a parent dying or an illness or having kids, you know, all the people that you think you have in your community who are going to be there to help you, they don't necessarily show up in the way that you want them to or expected them to. Or if you, I mean, it's funny, I'm getting married in a few weeks, and, you know, like, you think like all these people are going to come to your wedding, and then they don't, you know, so it's funny. And then that's what crowdfunding does. It's the same thing. These people that you didn't expect are giving you $1,000 or, you know, spreading the word about your campaign all over their Facebook pages. And you're just going, wow, I totally didn't expect this.
When you did your crowdfunding campaign, were you doing it strictly to learn about the process, or was it because the money was important as well to actually, you know, get this book going? Because you've done it by yourself prior to this. I mean, you've written several great books prior to this that I know you didn't have crowdfunding for.
No, I didn't. And how I did that was the way any entrepreneur does anything, and probably how most of the people listening to you and me talk right now is you bootstrap, right? You get a little bit of money here, a little bit of money there, whatever's left over, you put it towards the next thing. And even though I run a successful PR firm, I have employees and overhead, and nobody's getting rich working for independent musicians, even though we charge premiums for what we do. And I'm amazed that that is true. Still, I do not have a large amount of money left over in reserve at the end of any month. So I really kept thinking, you know, what I really would like to do is work with a great web designer to help me with my rebrand. And I really would like a professional video series that I can afford to shoot. And I really would like a real editor to edit my books, because I'd never had the extra money for that. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to have a killer graphic designer and not someone that I hire on 99designs.com? And I decided that I really wanted to go for it. And also, I had been really working for years writing blogs and doing teleseminars and self-publishing books. And I had a large tribe of people that were on my newsletter list and following me on socials. And I thought, no time like the present. Let's see, you know, if I can do this. So I really did want to raise that money. And I had a very clear vision about what I wanted to do with it. I didn't know how hard it was and how unusual it is to raise $50,000. That was a totally insane goal. But I'm glad I did it. And I'm still to this day, like, shocked that I reached that goal. But the things that I learned along the way were even more valuable than the money. But the money obviously was incredibly helpful to get all these projects off the rails.
The one thing I kind of enjoyed reading, only from, oh, I don't know what standpoint, it was the fact that you and your mother, the conversation about how she felt that it was embarrassing somehow for you to do this, to ask strangers for money. And yet that's the crux of crowdfunding.
Yeah. And I think that's that story, that little antidote about my mother, you know, feeling shame, shame on the family. It's not the first story that I have about that. In fact, a lot of artists and clients that I work with have said to me, like, My husband is really embarrassed that we're doing this. My bandmates are horrified that we're doing this. And, you know, I'm really the only one in the band that wants to do this. And I'm sort of pushing everyone. And I mean, it's funny. I think it's getting less so, but I remember the first time that I saw a major label artist was running a Kickstarter campaign. This was years ago now. And I thought, how dare that person? That's not an independent broke artist. I mean, of course I wasn't thinking. And then of course I thought, of course that person is not printing money. Like they're like all the rest of us. They just happen to have a record deal. Lucky them or not, depending on how you look at things. And this is the thing. It's getting better now, but I think there is still a lot of embarrassment. Like somehow we're all supposed to be rich from working in a world where Spotify earns all the money. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Like, so that's the ugly truth. And luckily there's more and more artists, mainstream artists. Like I won't never forget when the band Fun won their Grammy award. And even though the lead singer is, you know, married or dating Lena Dunham and they seem so popular and they were blowing up at the time, you know, he gets up there and he says, I want to thank our parents who have let us all live at home with them for the last few years. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's something that is the dirty side. You know, there's so much glorification of what it really looks like to be a rock star. But the truth is, you know, I mean, Benji from Pledge tells a story of being in his band, Marwood, and with his wife on an air mattress and on the road, and he was succeeding. He was touring and life was great, and he was selling lots of tickets to shows, and there he was on an air mattress in someone's kitchen with his wife going, this sucks. You know, this is no way. You know, that's what actually led him to decide to start Pledge Music. It's a very powerful story. So we need to do this.
I just had Jack Conte from Patreon, Pamplemousse, on. And he was telling me that 2 years prior to Patreon, he was living in his family's basement. It was the same thing. And even though they were making money, and he eventually made enough money to buy a house, he said that it was just incomprehensible that 2 years later, he would have raised almost $50 million in funding for Patreon. But it just goes to show you that everyone looks, I mean, they had commercials that they did and so visible on YouTube, and you think, wow, they must be doing really well. And, you know, it's not the case sometimes. What you see on the outside is not necessarily what's really going on.
Right. Right. And, you know, corporate greed is powerful.
Yeah.
You know, ain't nobody getting rich on YouTube anymore. You know, so, I mean, I think that that's the other thing is like, you think things. And yeah, I'm so glad you had Jack on. He's ever since I saw his talk, it's like 4 years old now in EXO. He's so inspirational and it's so cool. And more artists need to tell the truth about what this really is and how hard this really is and how far your money doesn't go. It's important to look at.
Well, back to crowdfunding for a second. What do you feel are the biggest mistakes that crowdfunders make? Or is there one overwhelming mistake that they seem to make if they're not funded?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I see, and from all the studies I read, and in CrowdStart, I do put a lot of statistics in to just kind of bring us all back down to earth. The first thing, which I think is the prelude to the mistake, is the average crowdfunding campaign, and that is the average of all of them. We're not just talking about music, right? Raises $7,000. So, you know, if you need 25 or 50 or 10, you have to start with that is a large, very large amount of money. And I think the big mistake after just aiming for too much is it looks easy. You just go to Kickstarter or you go to Indiegogo or you go to Rocket Hub or you go to Pledge and you just sign up. Create your tiers and put it on Facebook and the world's going to come. And it turns out that social media does play a role in your crowdfunding campaign. But as I really break down in the book, that is not where you're going to get your pledges. That is not where the money is going to come from, really. It's just a accentuation point. So the real gold is in there, but it's really about understanding your crowd and building them way before you launch. And that's where I see mistakes, is artists think that it's easy. They see other people. You read about Amanda Palmer getting $1.2 million. You read about, you know, all these people having these crazy successful campaigns, and you think, I can do that too.
Yeah, if you don't have a fan base, you really can't crowdfund when it comes down to it, because people aren't going to find you. Mostly, they're not going to, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not only about a fan base. It's like, do you have a family? Do you have, like, people that you participate in your world with? Like, are you on a soccer league, or do you go to church? Or, you know, you have to remember, it's not just your fans that you're asking. It's your entire community. And I think there can be a little bit of uncomfort there. It's like, I don't want to ask the dude in my soccer league, but that guy's probably streaming your music on Spotify for free and would be delighted to give you $25. Yeah. You just didn't ask.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, what are the ideal tiers? How many, and at what price points?
So back to stats, it's good to have somewhere between 5 and 7 tiers. That's what the most successful crowdfunding campaigns have. So you don't want to have too many. And I know it's a bit antithetical, because especially you're like, well, I can have $1 and $5 and $10 and $25. And so you have to be really mindful of how many tiers that you actually put in, because you want to make sure that you don't overwhelm people with too many. And I don't recommend doing like a $1 or a $5 tier, because if someone's going to give you $5, they might give you 10 or 25.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, start a little bit higher. I think that that's important to do. And then really think the tiers through. Sorry, I said 5 to 7. It's 7 to 9. 7 to 9 is a good amount. So definitely a lot of studies show the $75 amount is really good, 50 to 75. So you want to have some things that are in the $25 to $75 range. Don't make crazy jumps. Like, don't go from $75 to $500. You might want to put something in the $100, $150. And then you should have, I did about 7 or 9 tiers, I think. And then I did actually, I did a crazy one only premium platinum total stretch goal tier, which was $7,500. And I really did not think that anyone would want that tier. I thought, I'm just going to put it on this page. And I could not believe it. I actually had someone who I'd never heard of before bought that tier on my campaign. A perfect stranger called me up and said, I'm trying to process this tier, but Rocket Hub won't actually accept this much money. They don't accept this much money. So I had to process, it was amazing. I was processing her credit card on my mobile phone in a grocery store, literally like 3 days before my campaign ended. And she did $7,500 in one go. So I would also advocate for a stretch goal tier as well.
Rewards, I think, are a big deal. And I think for most crowdfunders, that's one of the hardest things to come up with. What can you actually give to people? Because really, when it comes down to it, it's like, okay, I can give you a CD. If you're a musician or an artist, I can give you a CD and t-shirts and hats and stuff like that. But those are so mundane that you can get anywhere. It's like, you have to really be creative on the rewards. What advice do you have there?
People love experiences, and I think you should absolutely consider what kind of experience can you create for your fan base, and do some really fun things, like go bowling with the band, or mystery box of something, which Antigone Rising did. And that's, whenever they do their crowdfunding campaigns, and they do them often every couple of years to raise money for their albums, they have mystery box. And it could be like, you know, an old, like, cool antique from one of their houses with, you know, some cool merch and some personal, you know, they just put all kinds of fun things in those boxes and their fans go crazy for them. So that could be an idea. Or throw an 80s themed prom and have everyone come in a tacky dress and, you know, play one or two of your songs from your forthcoming album, but have a dance party. Or I don't know. There's a million. Benji from Pledge often talked about there was a woman that raised money early on the Pledge music platform. She happened to be a baker, and she was doing these fabulous meetups in Central Park where you could meet her on a picnic blanket, and she would have cookies or cakes or scones or something fun, and you could have like the mystery treat with her in Central Park. And she also did wedding cakes. I live in New York City, and I'm about to get married. I can tell you that wedding cakes are not cheap. So she had a tier in her crowdfunding campaign where she's like, I will bake you or someone you know a fabulous wedding cake. And she sold those tiers out. And those are several hundred dollars a pop, money in her pocket. Her friends that had friends getting married spread the word about her campaign. So, you know, it doesn't only have to be about hats and t-shirts and vinyl and, you know, all the obvious things, but figure out what's your special talent, you know, and see if you can weave that in to your campaign. And I think that makes it fun and gives something extra for people to do.
Josh Fries, who's the drummer for Devo and Perfect Circle, among many others, this is maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
It's the best ever.
The best ever, right. But he had a tier for $75,000, and someone actually bought it, and that was completely experiential. Spend a week with him. He'd write with their band. You'd go around Hollywood, all the hot spots in Maynard from Perfect Circle in his Lamborghini, and someone bought it. 75
yeah.
grand.
I know. Yeah. It's fantastic. You know, like, so that's the beauty of a crowdfunding campaign. Yes, he had notoriety, so we might not be able to pull off a $75,000 tier, but what could you do? Like, what could you do if you just thought about, like, something so outrageous? I mean, that's outrageous, driving around in a Lamborghini in Hollywood and co-writing with Devo. I mean, oh my goodness, so cool, Perfect Circle.
Yeah.
Like, there you go. So definitely borrow from that page and do your own spin on that.
And, you know, he actually did it on his own website. He didn't use a crowdfunding site. And this is a little right before crowdfunding became popular, using the popular platforms anyway. But it leads me to another question. Why would somebody use a platform if you had your own infrastructure that you could do this yourself?
My simple answer is because most of us don't have our own infrastructure. Make no mistake, there are a lot of moving parts to a crowdfunding campaign. How do you communicate with all of the people that donated? How do you gather their mailing addresses? How do you set up a attractive page with all the different tiers? How do you structure where you're going to send everyone? I don't recommend it unless you've got the tech side of your house dialed in pretty deeply. And a lot of artists say to me, oh, I can just do it on my own, on my website, and then we don't have to give Kickstarter the percentage, whatever. I don't advocate for that unless you've got a team that can kind of handle your back end, because a lot of surprises come up. Like, you've got all your rewards and still people have not given you their mailing address, or you have a little bump in your road and you might not be able to deliver your campaign goodies as fast as you thought you would. And then how are you going to communicate with everyone really easily without, you know, spamming your whole email list? These are all things you definitely need to consider. So, and the platforms are there to help you. Indiegogo has fabulous tutorials that will walk you through how to be successful. Pledge Music, you get an advocate who holds your hand through the entire campaign, who you can call. I mean, these are special things that you should not take for granted.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, definitely. There are several companies that I've noticed just in the audio space that have used Kickstarter, and these are successful companies, and some are startups, but they've used it as a way of marketing a new product. So they can easily fund the product on their own, but just to raise product awareness, they put a Kickstarter campaign together. So where do you come down on that?
Brilliant, right? Because you're identifying who are your early adopter nerds who want access to the thing first? This is not only valuable for us as musicians, this is valuable for any company that's looking for their tribe, looking for their super fans. Because once you have that person's name and address and you know what they like and you know what they'll pay for, imagine the possibilities. You can continue to communicate with those people forever. And you've got real fans that can actually help you with product development and help you with feedback. And I mean, I think that the world of the impersonal, you know, advertising and just kind of big box marketing is so done. This is such a great way of going, look at this. Bobby loves this type of microphone and he's willing to pay extra for it 5 months before it's out in the marketplace. Now let me look at Bobby and figure out how Bobby can be helpful to me. I mean, it's genius.
Yeah, this is happening more and more that I see. And again, companies that have been around for a while that could easily do this themselves are using this strategy with a crowdfunding campaign and doing it successfully as well. I don't think I've seen anyone fail with this so far, but then again, you'd figure if a company's been around for a while, it wouldn't happen anyway. You know, they've built an audience.
Right.
Yeah. What do you feel is the best crowdfunding platform? I know it's a loaded question, but, and I know they each have their own attributes, but is there a favorite that you have?
It's like Sophie's Choice. No, I think it really depends on your personality. In the book, and what I do talk about is I do advocate for partial raise because it does take so much work to get it all together and get a campaign launched and figure out what you're going to do. And obviously takes energy and time and effort and thought and a lot of preparation. So I do say that look at Indiegogo, especially if you have a charity that you want to do something in association with, because they have the brilliant charity possibilities connected to them. And look at Pledge, because with Pledge, they will work with you. If you make a goal that's way too big or is too much of a stretch, they'll help you take your goal down. And as you know, you don't have to show how much money you're going for. So the fan can't be judgmental. I like that. But if you're an all or nothing kind of person and you know you need X amount of dollars and you want to go for it and you want to throw your hat over the wall, Kickstarter is of course the mother of all of the platforms and maybe has the most household recognition. But it depends on your personality. But I am an advocate for a partial raise. And I would say for the music community, Pledge is wonderful. And if you have a charity that you want to donate or you want to get a nonprofit status for something, definitely look into Indiegogo.
Do you think that the profile of the crowdfunding platform is important? In other words, like you said, Kickstarter is the mother of all these platforms. Does that really matter in the end?
It's interesting. I crowdfunded 3 years ago and it was still really a little bit more on the early-ish adopter side. And a lot of people gave me feedback about Rocket Hub and said, I have not heard of Rocket Hub. Why didn't you use Kickstarter? I mean, my simple answer was because Brian Meese, who founded Rocket Hub, it was a friend and I wanted to support him. And I knew that if I was freaking out in the middle of the night, I could text him and he would answer me. And I just wanted the personal touch side of it. But there is something to it. People absolutely have heard of Kickstarter. And so I don't know. I don't think now that's super important, but certainly people associate GoFundMe with medical needs or raising money for tragedies. You know, that it's not really one that you use to make your album, although I have seen artists use it. But obviously we look at GoFundMe with someone's house got flooded or someone's equipment got stolen. And that tends to be the platform you turn to for that type of thing. So I think different platforms have different things that people associate them with. But yes, Kickstarter is the one that people tend to know. So you should consider it, but not necessarily. If you don't want to go for broke, it might not be the one for you.
I have just a few more questions for you. I want to get back to your book, which, again, I can't say enough good things about. Let's talk about PR for a second. One of the things about your new book is the fact that there's a lot about social media in there, and it comes at it from a very, very ease of use way. I really loved it from that standpoint, because you really made it simple for someone who isn't fluent with social media, who's not good at social media, to, you know, really get going on it. So I guess my question would be, in the last, 18 months since we've talked, what has changed in terms of social media that affects what you do in PR?
Oh boy. Every single blogger and music journalist and cool tastemaker obviously is on Twitter. And they, if you know what you're doing, can be approached there. Social media and PR are now completely collapsed. And they, in my mind, have been for a long time, but I think it's really, really important to get this, people. If you don't have social media, if you don't have regularity on, and it doesn't matter, there is no magic formula. Like, if you like Instagram, post photos. If you like writing long things, make blogs. If you like Facebook, because that's your thing, Facebook. And there's a lot of wonderful people who can teach you how to do anything really well. If Snapchat's your bag, go for it. If you love Twitter, like me, I don't care what everyone keeps saying about Twitter. It is not going anywhere anytime this week. I'm still using it. Pick one. Don't worry about the trends and what they're saying, but get really good at one, because if you're going to try to build your brand, and especially if you're going to try to crowdfund, people are watching. They want to see that there's something. I am still stunned when bands and artists call me and they want PR, but they have no social presence, or they have a really, really super low numbers on social, or they bought fake things and there's super high numbers. Like, either way, that's not good either. So I know it's annoying and you have to do it every day and it's stupid and it's narcissistic and it drives you crazy and you don't like what the other person is doing. And I've heard every reason why it sucks in the book. I really have. I'm on the phone all day long with clients that pay us a lot of money to do PR. But if your social media sucks, and if you don't understand how to use it and leverage it, you're not going to get PR. I promise you, those music blogs in Hypem, those important journalists, they are looking to go, okay, if I write about this artist, will they be able to share the word about my writing with their communities? Make no mistake, it is a two-way street now. So PR and social media go hand in hand. The hardest clients for us to represent at our agency on the PR side of the house are the ones that refuse or don't like or don't do social media well. And that does not mean you need to hire someone like me to, you know, really do it all blue chip, go crazy, tweet 20 times a day and find all the tastemakers. You don't even need to do that. You just need to get consistent. But it is so, so important. Don't hire a publicist without having your social media first.
You know, I have to say, I get, I can't tell you the number of press releases every day or the number of communications from PR people.
It's awful. And they're not targeted to you. And they didn't take the time to even know what you do. I mean, I approach you, three times a year, because I know what you do. And I'm not tooting my own horn here, because there's a lot of people and I don't know what they do, and I would never approach them until I figured it out. But that is PR 1.0, to use the Bobby 1234.0 paradigm, right? That is like, I write a press release, I vomit it out into the world, and I hope some spaghetti sticks to the wall. This is the worst type of publicity. It is antiquated, dead. Anytime an artist calls and says, well, are you going to write me a press release? Our answer is 100% of the time, no, we are not. And it's a shame. I wish that we could just ban press releases. I mean, unless, of course, it's for an event, it's topical because I live around the corner, or it's very, very big, important, newsworthy news. Those are the only two times.
You know, it's interesting, though. Sometimes I get press releases I can't even read, that are formatted poorly, that the type is so small, or stuff like that. It's like, you're getting paid money for this? How does this work? You know?
I know, again, it's that sort of, I think all of us, every single one of us, including me, we all have this hope that there's going to be someone who can come and, make us famous or help us or fix us or get us to the next place. And, publicists are supposed to be those people, but it's very hard to do it right, and it's very hard to get good results. And unfortunately, there's a lot of pressure. I'm on the other side of the desk. I can't tell you how many artists have almost demanded, like, write a press release about our new album. I'm like, look, you got to go to someone else because that ain't news and nobody's going to read that.
Yeah. Well, good for you for standing up for that. That's great. Ariel, how can people get your book?
Oh, I'm so happy you asked. I'm giving away a free chapter at my website, which is new. It's arielhyatt.com. And you'll see you can download a little sampling if you and the table of contents, so you can check it out. You will also see on that page there'll be a couple of different offerings. You can order a hand-signed copy straight from me, or you can order it. There's a pre-order on Amazon with a bunch of bonuses. And then, of course, after October 25th, it will be available on Amazon and from my website as well at arielhyatt.com. Or you can visit us at cyberprmusic.com. There'll be links there as well.
Well, I can't recommend it highly enough. I just found it to be well written, and the information is dynamite, topical, easy to grasp. You did a fabulous job. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled that you like it. It means so much. I admire your writing and your work. And as a fellow champion for independent artists in the social media space, that means so much coming from you.
Thanks for being with me, Ariel. To find out more about cyber PR, you can go to cyberpr.com, cyberpr.com. To order a copy of Ariel's book, go to arielhyatt.com/all-about-crowdstart. So that's arielhyatt.com/all-about-crowdstart. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.